Welcome to the Three Crones podcast, a concoction stirred up by three wise women to encourage us all to embrace our authentic selves and open our hearts to each moment of the beauty and struggle that is real life. Together, we are redefining what it means to be women who have made many trips around the sun by leaning into the wisdom, power, wholeness, and radiance that naturally come with age. I'm Virginia.
Three Crones podcast is envisioned as an audio woman's circle, a sacred space to get to know and to get comfortable with our truest selves. In circle, we welcome everyone. We honor our unique differences. We recognize sacred sisterhood, and we support radical self-care. I'm Tamara.
We'll talk about it all. Loss and longing, sovereignty and grace. At a time when it feels like the world is coming undone at the seams, we choose to meet at the crossroads to see how the river, the trees, a fresh breeze, sunshine and moonbeams mend and remember us back to sanctuary. I'm Susan. We're three crones in the woods. What could go wrong?
Hello, all of you listeners, you intrepid listeners. Here in February, I'm Virginia McKinney, and I'm joined by my fellow crone, croness, Tamara Sheen. We're missing a crone right now, but hopefully at some point later on this month, she'll jump in and get her two cents worth on this topic, because we're going to be talking about sex. We're recording the day before Valentine's Day. So, of course, you know, how much money do we pour into this whole notion of sex? And, of course, it must be enrobed in love. And we'll talk about that, because really, do we need to enrobe it in love? And can't love be different, but not necessarily divorced from, I don't know. So we're going to sort of plow through some of that craziness that has been imposed upon us. One of the ideas that Tamara and I were talking about before we even went live on the recording, as it were, is this idea that years and years ago during the matriarchy, a young woman who began her menses was taken into the red tent or into the moon lodge and gotten a little drunk. They gave her wine or mead or, you know, whatever alcohol of the society was available, and they pierced her hymen. They broke her hymen so that it was not, first of all, it didn't cloud the act of the first sexual encounter, so there wasn't the pain involved in it. And there wasn't the sort of preciousness to be had of a virgin other than a woman gives her blood back to the Great Mother, back to the earth. And that was, you know, basically perverted by the patriarchy to make sure that they were, in fact, the holders of the woman and could make sure that any child born was theirs. Therefore, the woman had to come into the partnership, into the marriage, a virgin, so that men could ensure that no other man had been there, nobody else had impregnated her. And I remember when Diana and Charles got married, I was horrified at the notion that this young woman had to undergo an exam. Virgin. It was like, well, yeah. He's not. We know he's not. Anyway, exactly. All of that, you know, and Tamara, you say what you have to say about how this got, this perversion of women's sexuality and changed into a way of possessing women, how that was changed in your mind by institutions.
Yeah, institutions. I mean, obviously the church was the big one. And I'll read it a little bit later, but I just found this little passage by Rilke about that. And he wrote that in, as a man, wrote that in 18 something, which just pertaining to that. And I think also sort of the whole shift from indigenous beings to so-called civilized, right? There you have also this huge sort of leap. And obviously it happened over millennium, but oh my goodness. I mean, just think to ancient Greece or Egypt and the rites and the activities that were required of a priestess and the sacred sexuality that was included in all of that. Those were not the little angels standing in the Catholic Church who were pure and virginal and at all. They were women who were initiated by women into their sacred awareness of what sex has in the totality of our natural world, right? Because isn't that the whole story of creation and the whole story of the natural world? You know, Demeter, Persephone, and, you know, the whole sort of our whole mythology springs from that and from and it clearly got very redirected and the telling of the stories became more and more by men, for men, for the pleasure of men, and for control over those mysteries, because those mysteries were deeply rooted into the goddess or from the goddess of, you know, and are the earth mysteries, and they would and still are, because we are, that is still living in the world and is coming to a forefront again. I mean, there's a resurgence of these earth mysteries and of women stepping into their power, and also priestess culture being, I mean, it's fascinating and people are fascinated by it. And there's a lot of that, you know, coming back in a way, or looking at the ancient ways and informing reclaiming our womanhood and autonomy.
Yeah. I think one of the crucial things that you just said that just like poked me between the eyes is the idea of autonomy. And, you know, whether you are or one has chosen a sex or determined to remain the same sex as what you were determined by birth, it is absolutely the case in at least 99% of the births, not all of them, but most of them, where the child is born, the person who is there, whether it's a doctor or a nurse or, you know, a caregiver of some sort, says, oh, it's a boy or it's a girl. What was unknown suddenly becomes known. We drop it into a category, and there you are for the rest of your life. Notion that you might be a girl with, you know, more masculine propensities. I certainly was. I wanted to ride horses and play in the mud and stump my toes. And I didn't want to play with dolls. I didn't want to do the, you know, things that most little girls who were 8 years old did. And I know I had much more fun playing with boys than I did girls. And that does not mean that, you know, I wish I were a boy, although there are times I think, I mean, my life would have been easier if I had been a man in a great many ways. But, you know, which I'm sort of rambling here, but it leads me into the notion, and I may very well catch some flack from this, because I understand the idea of, oh, I was born this way, as a means by which we sort of, as a society, allow people to determine their own outcome, or at least to be comfortable in the outcome of sexuality that they find themselves in. And I'm not saying this very well. I'm circling around this. But I'm trying to get back to the notion of, in truth, what you do sexually, if it's by choice, in other words, if it's consensual and you're an adult, it doesn't make anybody, it's nobody else's business. What you choose, and whether that is determined by a hormonal fluctuation in your mother's uterus, or whether it's something, you know, you simply decide to choose. I have friends who were married, one of whom had children, and yet they met in sort of midlife and fell in love and, you know, had a very successful and loving and good same-sex relationship that led to a same-sex marriage. That a choice? Who the fuck cares? Both happy, loving, and fulfilling of themselves. They determined their own outcome on this. So anyway, I rambled around on that.
I don't feel equipped in my own knowledge enough to go into that whole subject that is so prevalent right now in terms of our gender, because that's almost another podcast in and of itself. But I do say that the way I look at it is it's our humanity. You know, that anything that objectifies us as women or as men from the other side, you know, like in whatever format, and has constraints and rules and diminishes the humanity. Humanity has man in it. Humanity. How would that sound? The humanness or even the mammality, you know, since we're mammals, of our freedom. Maybe we just call it freedom. Anything that traps my freedom is not welcome, and is a perpetration, and is an intrusion on health and on well-being and on being the best person or the person that I'm meant to be. And so, yeah, I think therefore, you know, if we really look at this subject of sex and of intimacy, because you know, you can have one without the other. Intimacy without sex doesn't seem like such a bad thing. And sex without intimacy can be great. If it's something that you have consent and you've chosen, it's what, you know, I was thinking, I just said to Virginia before we started for a minute, you know, is that something that belonged more into my 20s? Was sort of like the more of the experimental and having, you know, and knowing I was going to just go, you know, enjoy myself sexually with another for the sheer exuberance and enjoyment of it. And I sort of went back to myself and said, well, is that, you know, and my brain self was saying, that's, you know, it's not really what I would want now. Now I would want something that was more mature and had the relational aspect. And then I was like, I'm not sure I answered to that question.
You know, the first sort of inhibition of a 67, 68 year old woman, which I'm sort of nearly 68 or will be this year. The drawbacks to a 68 year old woman just having sex just because the fun of it, they're there, but many of them have been blown away by age. I don't have to answer to anybody. My parents are dead. I don't have to worry about, you know, parental control or being parentally disappointed my parents in way or anything like that. So, and I'm very divorced in some way from a church and that constraint. So it's like, oh, yeah, I could run amok. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Now, maybe my husband would at least want me to run amok with him. You know, but it's things change. Things in our sexual lives change as we age. And that sort of leads me into my next point. I mean, you know, as a young woman, I look back on many of my years now as a young woman and think, some of the, quote, mistakes I made sexually, and most every one of them is, could be summed up in the little phrase, should have fucked them. You know, probably should have fucked him. You know, it's like, what was going on in my mind that I did not follow, you know, the urges of my body? And I was concerned enough that it would have been safe. It would have been consensual, all of that. So what was that inhibition that dragged me into sort of a form of suffering, you know? And certainly the men, you know, I'm sure the men, maybe men suffer this same sort of sexual oppression. I'm not sure.
I certainly think men have, and especially those who were raised in a strict church, particularly the Catholic Church, as we all know. You know, I mean, there, I mean, what we have seen go down in the Catholic Church over the last 20 years is right there, just says it all. And so, yes, and I think actually one of the reasons one of the reasons that there's such a problem with objectification of women and maybe relationships going awry on and the women experiencing this sort of lack of freedom is to do with sexually repressed men, you know, in a way. So like you can't really separate one from the other, because even if the woman didn't grow up that way, you've got the meeting there, and then the male has got all this kind of like gets into this headspace of like, oh, you know, it's a sin to have sex before marriage, or it's a sin to have sex, period. I don't know. I mean, if they were like raised strictly or Catholic education, you know, it's just like, wow. And again, I don't want to knock Christianity or people's belief systems at all in that way, or the Catholic Church for that matter, insofar as it's for some people their go-to. But we know that for every organized religion, there is a dark past and a dark present.
Yeah.
And I unfortunately.
I've often wondered if a lot of the abuse, primarily young men, but young women as well, in the church has to do with the repression of sexuality and the confusion of sexuality and innocence and attraction and all of that sort of, you know, dark muck.
Well, and just the fact that they weren't allowed to marry. I mean, just the fact that these priests weren't allowed to marry. So they had nowhere to... So they weren't able to fulfill an extremely important part of being human.
Understanding that celibacy as such was enacted by the church much later, more in like the 900s and the 1100s, 1200s, as a means to control the wealth of the priests, who were also maybe knights or people, men of land and substance. The Catholic Church didn't want that going to their children. They wanted it coming to the church. So you can't leave that to your wife. You bring it on home to Daddy God. So I think that's not healthy. We know that's not healthy. So.
No, and an age old, there we have it, you know, wealth and corruption and repression, right, all there together. So, okay, so then, well, I guess I have a question for you. You know, then, as grandmothers now, but also mothers of boys, you have two boys, I have two boys, I also have a daughter, but I mean, and you have daughter-in-law, how have we, first of all, raised our sons in a way, how much is what we, so much of our own experiences, right, go unconsciously into the raising of our children, but also how as grandmothers, I'm more interested in that where it skips the generation, because maybe just, you know, a little bit from my background, you know, my mother's mother was essentially a Victorian woman. I mean, she wasn't, you know, her mother was Victorian, but like that took two generations at least to sort of untangle. And I would say it was me that untangled it in my later adult years in terms of sexuality and freedom and all of that. But my mother and her mother definitely still had that, to the point where my mother never sat me down and gave me, you know, talked with me about it in any formal fashion, you know, not even the awkward, like sitting on the bed. I mean, she, you know, just in the nick of time, because I got my period really young. I got it. I was just 13, yeah. Which in those days was young, not anymore. Actually, I think I was still 12, but now I know that's all shifted and that's already an interesting topic unto itself. But, you know, she sort of sat me down and told me that my period would be happening, kind of thing, and about that. But there was no kind of like freedom of expression of we could talk about sex or any of that, me and my mother. And you know, I mean, I understand that wasn't the case across the board, but particularly in my British heritage and just who my family was, right? And then when it came to me and my daughter, yeah, I did do that, and I did have conversations, and her, you know, and I think then it just shifts. And the way I sort of feel is like, what if grandmothers were able, you know, because again, like, I would never have imagined my grandmother having that conversation with me. But as a grandmother now in this time, I could imagine having that connection to my granddaughter where we talk about it, or where I ask about her boyfriends or whatever, you know, like, you know, I don't know if that'll be the case, but I'm just saying it's sort of like, maybe that, you know, it sort of skips that,
yeah,
that relationship with the mother and the grandmother could come in. And like you were saying earlier, how the women in past times, you know, helped the young one come into their own body around the act of releasing the blood to the earth as opposed to giving it to the man. But like, just bringing about a different culture of initiation for women, you know. My daughter was very blessed to go to a beautiful camp in the summers with girls of her own age, where the leader of the camp was just wonderful in that way. And that was included in it all. And a beautiful rite of passage celebration that we held together for the girls.
And, yeah, it's wonderful.
You know,
and, you know, the whole rite of passage thing is, again, another podcast, because we don't do it in this society. Maybe the Jewish community does with bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs. But, you know, otherwise, we WASP, what makes a boy into a man? Well, you give them a gun and they go shoot something. They go out and kill something and suddenly they're a man. And that has to be really brutal for people, young men who don't have any inclination at all to want to kill something. So I do want to let all of our listeners know we are in no way any sort of sex experts, be it medically or psychologically, other than we lived through it. So, and we made it through.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we're having a frank conversation, as we usually do on these topics, where, and this one is, you know, just maybe a little more charged just because the societal repression of this particular subject. But you know, I do think rites of passage are a huge, huge way to initiate young people into, and through all the stages in life, to just, you know, I mean, just to put it really simply, just honoring
right,
the shift in a woman's body in a beautiful and celebratory way, rather than like, oh God, you know, you're getting your period and you're going to need this. And this, you know, like that wasn't done for me. You know, I've learned about that as an adult, and learned that, oh, you know, and the, I mean, I can just share briefly, you know, in our work in the moon dance, how many tears were shed when we had this incredible teaching from our Mexican abuela on the giving of the moon blood back to the earth, and how many of these young women who were all bleeding still just wept with, it was like relief, but also, oh, why didn't I know this before? Or why is this something that isn't done? Or why haven't I done that for my child? And even the older women, why didn't my child experience, you know, I was actually mourning that for my own daughter, like, you know, yes, we did something, but like, how much work there is to be done on this subject, so that women come into their bodies with autonomy, with also with love for their own body, with confidence. You know, there's one thing to be able to stand up to a man and or stand up to anyone for that matter, to stand as a strong, confident woman. But in a way, you have to, in order to really embody woman, you have to also have really got a relationship with your sexuality and your and be comfortable with,
exactly,
with your body.
Exactly. I mean, so I remember my first menses and all the energy surrounding it was this is something we don't talk about. We keep this quiet. No one knows. And you do this in secret in the bathroom. You take care of yourself. You certainly don't talk about it. Yeah. Just like any other sex, I was taught you don't talk about sex and you don't like sex and you don't have sex. And if you are going to have sex, you don't enjoy it. And if you do enjoy it, by all means, don't tell anybody, especially your partner. You know, it's like, oh my God, how reverse is that?
Wow.
I remember coming out of that in my first gesture of sort of moving into the reclamation of my own blood was after I had done a woman's wisdom training with my two beloved teachers, Hemitra Craycraft and Sue King. And I had the inclination that I followed that, and I was still bleeding then. I went home and created for myself. I mean, I sort of decorated. Susan would be proud of me. I practiced a craft work around a bucket that I kept next to my toilet. And when I began to bleed, I filled it with water. And at that point, I had reverted to actually using washable pads rather than tampons or anything like that. I would drop those pads in that bucket to soak. Freaked my husband out. I was like, oh my God, what's going on in the bathroom? Is this a science project? Because of course, women's menses is not talked about, even with your partner who's, you know, he's open-minded. And anyway, end of my period.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when it was ready, time to clean the pads, I would take them out, wash them. But that blood water, I would water my plants with. And I'm telling you, plant took over.
Yeah.
And you had bloody
nice plants.
And, you know, it's like, these are fluids that are filled with nutrients and life and richness and iron and all these minerals. Of course you give it back to the earth. Why not? Why not? So that's for all women out there who are still bleeding or who have daughters about to bleed, that's a wonderful exercise. It's a wonderful way of breaking through the sort of secrecy and, you know, ooh, icky. Just get rid of all that. We don't need that anymore. We don't need that at all. Mm. So, and, you know, I was thinking also about how sex and sexuality has changed as we aged. Ooh, that was interesting. One of the things that
something just popped up on the phone. I thought I had the volume off. There we go. It's all real here.
It is real. There's no planning.
It was probably something very appropriate. But go ahead.
So moving from maiden to motherhood, talk about change in the age. I was pregnant. During my pregnancy, I noticed an abrupt shift in how men looked at me and treated me. I felt the sort of no longer sexually interested in you. I mean, whoa, you're pregnant. I had men who came up and actually rubbed my belly. And this was at work. Oh, excuse me, what the fuck was that all about? I felt that shift in sexual tension, sexual interest, whatever. It was clear.
Yeah.
And So
classic.
Moving out of motherhood into grown. I mean, first of all, you know, being married, you sort of pull yourself back from the sexual, you do generally, I did, pulled myself back from the sexual marketplace, as it were. But so it wasn't quite as abrupt, but certainly how men treat me now is quite different from how they treated me 40 years ago or 20 years ago even. So, and I don't know whether I like it or not. I think I do, but I'm not certain. I'm still kind of getting my ears here with some comfort. So what about you? Did you, during your transitions from to mother, mother to crone?
I was a super young mother. And, you know, I'd had a fair bit of whatever you want to call it, you know, relational experience before I met my now ex-husband, the father of my children. But yeah, I think I was aware of that. But I think I was so all consumed with my pregnancy with that first baby because I was so young and it was an unplanned, so as they say, pregnancy. I definitely remember feeling vulnerable in it before baby came, and after baby came, I felt like I could take on the world, and it gave me so much confidence in my body and in my, because I, you know, I had a very blessed, beautiful home birth and was very blessed with the whole way it went. But, you know, and my body was young and very capable, you know, which I kind of was like, oh, I can do this. But having said that, all through that marriage, which was about 11 years in total, sort of 11 and then 12, the 12th year being very disintegrating, I would say, and then ending in divorce, I was a person who did want, I did continue to try to please, not just my husband, but men in general, that there was that aspect. It was only after my divorce that I really started to work with my womanhood and my, and again, that was, you know, 32.
Right.
I was still very young. But yeah, but still, like, you know, just to go on that journey of discovery, of self, of really self-discovery, human, you know, I'll say womanhood, but humanhood, you know, self-discovery of who I was. And really only when I met my, and I had a couple of dates between my, you know, really, I didn't date men. I was raising three children single-handedly. I made a very sort of, like, I wasn't particularly interested in men after my husband and I divorced for various different reasons, which I won't, you know, go into here. But it wasn't that I became a man hater or anything. I just wasn't that interested. So it went from sort of pleasing men and being attracted to them and flirtation, maybe being a bit of a flirtatious person because I'm sort of I'm social and sanguine, and I enjoy flirting. I think it's fun. You know, I've always loved it. Sort of to somebody who was just very much focused on my own development and raising my children. And it was a sort of self-enforced celibacy, not enforced. It was actually a choice. I just sort of chose to be in a way celibate and was quite, I think it was a little bit like keeping the moon blood inside before its time, you know, sort of that kind of image of like keeping that sexual, but it being like, I'm reclaiming that and I'm going to hold it, not as something too precious, but just something that I'm going to, next time I give that out, it's going to be on my terms. It's going to be on my terms and it's going to be beautiful and it's going to be real, you know? And it was, I mean, I had a couple of dates and then I met my second husband, you know, who became my second husband, and we had what I would call a real ecstatic love. I mean, we were not only incredibly compatible in every way, but sexually too. And it was an absolute mind blow. You know, it opened me up to something that I'd never even knew existed in the world. You know, for me, it was like, this is what it can be. And this is what people talk about or what I was sort of imagining or dreaming. But so yes, and felt very blessed that I experienced that in my life, and that kind of a love, and coupled with a very, very deep love, and and intimacy and sort of as above, below, you know, the real, the sacred feminine and masculine. I could feel that, and I think that's what I would wish for all women, you know, and men, is that merging, all women and women and men, or, you know, all humans. Again, excuse me that I don't want to put this all into masculine, feminine, but I speak from my own experience. But, you know, that intimacy that we share, whether it's physical, whether it's, you know, whether it's sexual intimacy, physical intimacy, mind intimacy, all of that, that it's done with this, with freedom and with a certain, you know, this larger, that it comes, it's an inheritance, right? It's not just trend.
I'm sitting here imagining, like, what would it be like if we lived in a world where we began to realize this sort of sexual autonomy, agency? This is mine. I think this is real. I get to choose with whom or if I share it. I mean, you know, what's wrong with that?
Wow.
I get to choose. This is mine. This is me. However that looks, whatever that looks like, great. You know?
Yeah, isn't that? Yeah, that's such a sort of different perspective. And also sort of how do we teach that? And how do we, you know, because of course we are in a time now where children get sex education much earlier, and there's books and there's pictures and there's, you know, it's not anymore this repressed thing, and that's all good and well and good. But is the sacred piece, for me, I feel, and I don't mean, when I say sacred, I don't mean religious. I don't mean, it's as physical and as, gorgeous as anything, but like this sort of, that it's a lineage, that it's something that we deserve, you know. How do we impart that sense, like we do with a child, when we want to teach them about something that, oh, there's the scientific aspect, there's the beauty, the physical beauty aspect, there's the wonder, there's the surprise. I'm talking about a young child. There's reverence, all of those things for nature, right? So how do we teach that about our bodies as well? So that it's not just anatomical. That's important. Hugely important that we understand how things work, and we understand that we can get pregnant if we don't, you know, all of that. But how do we also engender this, how incredible it can feel, and how it's, you know, it, and if you don't feel good, if you're not feeling good in that moment, and you're feeling afraid, or you're feeling that you don't have power, then get out of there. How do you get out? Yeah. How do we, you know, I mean, how shouldn't get in the first place, but all of that, like, you know, and then there is, you know, this whole subject of, you know, that we haven't consented, you know, unconsensual and all of that, you know, it's just so important somehow to give children that autonomy.
Yeah.
Before it happens, before the body changes and you're like the hormones are flowing and you're in a situation with a, you know, the young boy is in a situation with a, let's just shift it for a minute. You know, it's not always the girl with a overpowering girl who's saying, oh, I want this.
I think one of the few things that I may have done well and I can name them like on three fingers, but one of the few things I may have done well, right, my boys, I told them, like, when they were 10 or 11 and we were talking about sex, although we did tend to talk about it as they were growing up, no means no. And if the partner you're with is playing some sort of head games with you or even with themselves, and they're saying no, but they mean yes, run as fast as you can, because you don't want to have any sort of sexual relationship with someone who doesn't claim their own sexuality.
Exactly. Yeah. Which I mean, but when you say that, Virginia, I mean, that's absolutely great. But when you say that and you think about how young kids are getting involved these days, And again, I don't want to sound like the old grandmas. Oh, they shouldn't get involved that young. But like how you're also, what one's also doing is wakening the child, you know, because you want it to be safe and consensual and all these things, you're sort of having to do that younger and younger and younger. And so where is that, you know, and are they really, again, because it is not, it's not just the physical body, it's also the maturity, you know, that we need maturity to understand those dynamics and to understand that no means yes, yes means no. I mean, like, does a 12 or a 13-year-old understand that? It's like, whoa. So that's a great tool. And that's a good, what I say, that you know, that was a great, a gift for your boys. But I sort of think at the same time, you know, and I did the same, you know, and respect and treating, you know, treating girls with respect and their opposite, and also everyone, humans, their fellow friends too. But at the same time, it's just sort of like, oh my goodness, it's there. They delve into that. They jump into that. And before you know it, mistakes are made. And it's sort of how to, so that's where I come back to the ritual again, the rituals of starting rituals young, not just rituals around sexuality, but rituals around anything. And so that by the time they're getting to that age, it's kind of like, oh, and this is another milestone that we, or a portal that we go through in order to learn on a somatic level. You know, I think we have to learn these things in our bodies as well as intellectually.
I think so too. And I think if we were to strip away a great deal of the bullshit, socially and psychologically and emotional blackmail that has enrobed our sexuality, if we strip that away, it's like, well, how do we teach our kids to play tennis or basketball? Well, they start out, they're not very good at it. They learn to control their bodies. Eventually, they start learning the rules. And then eventually, if they're on a team, they learn to play really, really well by, you know, knowing the rules and how to read a court or whatever.
Yeah.
Now, not to put too much of a sort of overlay of that symbol onto sexuality, of course, you're going to make mistakes when you're in your youth. Always. And that certainly is going to pertain to sex. So if we were to open the conversation and strip away the bullshit surrounding it, maybe our children would have such a hard time, even making mistakes, even messing up would be okay. Another person
would be okay.
Hurt. So that's where you really, it has to be almost a complete social stripping away. In other words, every child who participates, every person who participates has to be in agreement. So, you know, we've not done our children a whole lot of favors on this. Certainly my generation, I think, wildly impacted by a great many negative influences on sexuality. And I hope I lifted that burden at least a bit for my children. So,
yeah, me too. I do feel like that I did, I think. But, you know, it's again, it's interesting. It's kind of making me want to go to my three adult children and talk about it with them. it'd be so interesting to know what their journeys have been without, you know, they don't need to disclose details to their mother, but just like as a general subject. And something that I always love watching when I see those sort of nature programs, I love the fact, you know, I just love to look to the animals as our sort of higher, you know, like dolphins, for instance. They just have sex for enjoyment. They just like, ooh, you know, like that's where I feel it, like that those ocean creatures that just go for it with abandon and with like. And so the whole thing lifts up to be so joyful that there is no separation. You know, I remember, you know, just that whole sort of the whole aspect of, you know, sex during the day versus sex during the night, you know, and I've always been someone who loves sex in the morning. You know, I want to be able to see the person. I want that, you know, just sort of like in the dark, turn out the light, you know, like sort of, and that's fine too. I'm not saying dark isn't a beautiful time to have sex as well, but just like that, being that comfortable you know, that's what I want for the young people to feel this, and for all of us, and for myself. Just that, yeah, that it's part of life. It's not a separate thing. You know, it's not hidden. It's not separate. It's part of life. It's naturally part of life. You know, animals are at it all the time. You know, like, but that it can also be such a violation. You know, it can also be such a subject that is so has been so misused and violated, and there's so much pain and hurt that has come from it, and to the point where there are some people who will never experience that joy in their lives because they've been violated, because, you know, it's too painful. And that is a shocking and shameful thing that has come out of, I mean, I think we're kind of going full circle now to the beginning, you know, that has come out of our societal and millennium of repression and patriarchal war on women. I'd love to hear your poem. I know you had a poem. I don't know if this is the right moment.
I'm hesitating about reading it right now. I do want to maybe end on a somewhat lighter note. Oh, yeah. Remember, my older son in high school finally came to me and he put his hand on my shoulder, and I thought, oh, this is going to be a deep talk. He said, Mom, I have a real request for you. And I'm like, okay. You know, he said, stop buying condoms for me. I do not need any more condoms. He said, I had been buying them at Costco. No, I don't know. I didn't want the boy to run out. You know, stop buying me condoms. It's like, okay, that's a clear message. So he became completely autonomous in his own condom buying from here on out. So
there you go. And probably in his that's beautiful. Oh
well, gee, I'm talking to you about this. Oh. And you know, boy, this maybe should be another episode. Happy Valentine's Day. It will be past Valentine's before this actually hits the airwaves,
right? But it's our dear third crone's birthday tomorrow on Valentine's.
Then her granddaughter. So there really is a matriarchal line wrapped around Valentine's Day energy in Susan's household. So
right. And maybe, you know, I'm thinking already ahead into another podcast, because I feel like whenever we do this, but especially on a big topic like this, there's so many subtopics. And I think it would be wonderful to continue this conversation around more specifically rituals for young women, and how we can, how we can prepare them and also just young people in general, you know, rites of passage. I'd love to have a whole thing on that. And also love, you know, how love comes into it all, because, you know.
That's a biggie. Well, happy Valentine's Day tomorrow.
To you too, dear Virginia. Lovely talking to you.
We'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to go to our Instagram page and drop some questions or comments in general, please do. We'd love to hear from you.
And we might post a couple of poems up there too.
Yeah. All right, dears. Blessed be.
You've been listening to Virginia McKinney, Tamara Sheen, and me, Susan Madden Cox. We're three crones on a mission to stimulate meaningful conversations to create radical change and to provide a safe and soothing sanctuary for women. Be sure to download, to listen, check the show notes for good links, and follow us on Instagram at Three Crones Podcast. We want to hear from you, so send us your ideas, questions, and mind fires. Until next time.